The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
The Griswolds are not what you'd call savvy travelers. After bungling through America in National Lampoon's Vacation, the family took a drive through Europe.
I guess what we do is just drive around this circle here. It should be the second left exit. There's the hotel. Hey, look, kids! There's Big Ben and there's Parliament!
That is the dim-witted dad, Walt, played by Chevy Chase, driving his family around in circles. Literally, he's on the inside lane of a London roundabout and cannot get out.
It's amazing. I cannot get left. There's Big Ben, kids, Parliament.
It's a comic scene in the movie, but frustratingly familiar right here in the U.S. of A., where a lot of drivers don't really know how to use a roundabout, which can get messy given that they're becoming more popular across the country. Chances are you've circled a few right here in New Hampshire. This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today we're answering some of your quandaries about navigating New Hampshire and sharing some stories from the open road. Producer Hannah McCarthy starts us off by tackling a question from listener JJ, who writes, "We're seeing an influx of roundabouts replacing dangerous intersections in Keene, with two more just proposed. Is this happening elsewhere?" All right, JJ, we are hitting the road.
Thanks for the question, JJ. It is definitely happening elsewhere. Across New Hampshire, we are at 40 roundabouts and counting. And they're increasingly common across the country, too. Some states have hundreds. So, yes, roundabouts are definitely a thing. But if you want to know why they're a thing, you should stick around. Because I talked to three men who know roundabouts. Like, really know roundabouts. And they've got a lot to say on the matter. First things first, let's define our terms. Roundabout, traffic circle, rotary. It's all the same thing, right?
Rotaries. I have a hard time calling them that because we try to shy away from the terminology of rotaries.
This is Bill Oldenburg. He's the Assistant Director of Project Development for the New Hampshire Department of Transportation. According to Bill, roundabouts and rotaries are not the same thing, and the latter have kind of fallen out of favor in the world of highway engineering.
They're bigger, they're faster, they're not as safe.
If you've taken Route 1 through New Hampshire on the way to Kittery, Maine, chances are you've encountered the behemoth example of just such an intersection. It's the Portsmouth Traffic Circle, and it can be a little intimidating. So traffic circle and rotary, those are the same thing. Bill says traffic circles were introduced in the U.S. in the early 20th century, but there was no real design criteria, and they didn't process traffic very well either.
When traffic in the circle is going, 40 miles an hour, think of the gap that you need to pull into traffic. You need a big gap. You need hundreds of feet.
That means that a traffic circle can cause traffic of its own, but take that traffic circle and shrink it down and add a few rules, maybe throw in an extra lane, and you've got something special, the roundabout.
So you actually have less traffic in the roundabout. With a smaller circle, people are going 15 miles an hour. You don't need much of a gap.
Bill says that a lot of the roundabout construction in New Hampshire is actually a retrofitting of existing traffic circles. The engineers see better traffic flow and they think, all right, success. But the people driving through these things often have a different opinion.
I never feel comfortable going around them.
It bugs me that some people don't know how to drive through them.
Oh, that can be a problem. Sometimes people don't know how to use them, my daughter being one of them.
Oh, they're horrible. I hate them.
Hate them. Can't stand them.
Engineers are plenty aware of how the public feels about these intersections, but traffic flow isn't the only reason they're making the shift to roundabouts. They're also working to prevent accidents. More than 5 crashes a year at a particular intersection, and cities begin to reevaluate. They look at traffic count, turning movement, pedestrian and cyclist use, and, of course, crash history. Now, not every intersection is going to be turned into a roundabout, but it's going to work for some of them. I spoke to Ed Roberge. He's an engineer for the city of Concord. And whether you grumble about them or not, Ed says the data points to a roundabout being a great fix for some problem intersections.
Certainly in our case, with our roundabouts that we have here in town, you know, we've all but eliminated crashes at these intersections, and we've certainly eliminated likely all serious injury type of crash at the roundabouts here. It's been very, very positive.
The stats on roundabout benefits seem almost too good to be true. The Federal Highway Administration says they nearly eliminate fatalities, reduce injuries by 75%, and crashes go down by a third. So they work, and they seem to work better than other options, but Ed says they still take some convincing.
Getting in front of the public and making sure that we build, we certainly aren't roundabout crazy and want to slam this down everybody's throat. That's just not the way that we do business. But making sure that they understand the differences between, you know, leaving an intersection as it is or looking at a roundabout that's context sensitive, has benefits from a traffic capacity as well as safety aspect, and then showing them.
But roundabouts are still a major point of contention for a lot of people. That's partially because, intuitive as they seem, they still require some basic training before you know how to drive through them.
People just do not understand how roundabouts work.
Meet Mark McCullough. He's an engineer who works for Washtenaw County in Michigan. We didn't find Mark, by the way. Mark kind of found us. We tweeted about roundabouts, and he responded. He's a bit of an aficionado.
I like to put roundabouts at our intersections where they make sense. And we've been doing so dating back all the way to 2007. And we're up to 25, 26 roundabouts as we speak. And things have gone really well.
So Mark and his team are going along. They're identifying problem intersections and replacing them with roundabouts when it makes sense. And the results are pretty good. Until one day.
I met my nemesis, and it's an intersection just outside of Ann Arbor called State Road and Ellsworth Road. It was a two-lane, multi-lane roundabout that we put in 2013.
This was a high-volume intersection, and before the roundabout went in, they had a lot of traffic backing up and a lot of injuries. And this roundabout did help with those issues, but it came with some of its own.
What none of us projected would happen was we went to 170 non-injury fender bender crashes at that intersection the first full year it was open.
That's an average of over 42 crashes a year. Most of these crashes were because people failed to yield before entering the roundabout or turned from the wrong lane. So Mark looked to the front lines for help. Cops, he figured, were the enforcers of road rules. So he asked a state trooper to explain roundabouts in a Michigan paper.
The first thing that came out of his mouth was he told everyone how much he hates roundabouts and how he always feels like he's going to get in a crash and people are confused. And I thought to myself, really? Is that really how this is going to work?
Mark discovered that even law enforcement didn't know how these things worked. It wasn't part of their training. It wasn't part of anyone's training. So he decided to launch a statewide education campaign.
Our slogan here in Washtenaw County is Yield is Your Shield. You probably saw it on our Facebook page.
Mark and his team created radio and television PSAs.
Washtenaw County Road Commission here with your Tuesday traffic tip. When you approach that roundabout, remember, yield, don't merge, and always choose your lane before you approach.
They've launched a social media campaign complete with the hashtag Yield is Your Shield, asked insurance companies to get involved in information sharing, and even send school kids home with what Mark calls roundabout swag bags to teach their parents how to navigate these intersections. It's still early to tell if this outreach is working, but Mark says the country has encountered this problem before. Back in 1914, when Cleveland, Ohio, introduced the first traffic light. Even then, he says, the U.S. needed an education campaign.
Challenges are all similar, and I thought that was really unique. It made me feel good that, you know, our struggles were the same, and it's really no different today than back then. You use the same concepts and how to educate the public on how to do something, and then ultimately you probably get there just over the course of decades.
To Mark, roundabout resistance seems to be about misunderstanding these intersections more than anything else. As more people get to know them and their safety benefits, perhaps more people will get to like them. In the meantime, there are always people like Mark.
Me, I love them, but I'm a different kind of cat.
You can learn a lot more about roundabouts at nhpr.org. And while you're there, check out the results of our New Hampshire Rate Those Roundabouts survey. Granite Staters, as it turns out, are pretty open to doing laps, but there are still a few roundabouts that get people pretty riled up. Curious about what else you might be missing when it comes to the roads that you drive every day? Sometimes the more familiar you are with a place, the less you know about what it has to offer. That's what Casey McDermott found. She's a reporter for the NHPR newsroom who recently co-authored a piece for Boston.com pointing out some 100 things to do in the Granite State. Hello, Casey.
Hello.
Hi. So first of all, how long have you lived in New Hampshire?
A little over 3 years.
Do you feel like you've gotten to know the state pretty well?
Yeah. So I think one of the perks of being a reporter is that it has helped me to see more of the state than I might have otherwise. So, you know, I might have been asked to cover a meeting in Chichester or Epsom, and those are not places that I probably would have sought out on my own. And likewise, it's taken me to kind of all different corners of the state to cover different things in my job.
So you've had destinations. What do you think is it is that gets in the way of exploring the place you live in general?
So I live in Manchester. I used to live in Concord. I still work in Concord. So a lot of my week is spent kind of traveling between those two places. And I'm definitely kind of a creature of habit. So I have, you know, my favorite coffee shop, my favorite, you know, routine on Saturday to go to the farmer's market. So I think just that kind of, okay, I live here and I feel like a little bit of a local now and just kind of reverting to the same places I go to over and over again because of that.
Well, how do you make a plan then to explore your new home state?
So I think it's a little bit of word of mouth, not the show, but just talking to, you know, my friends who are either locals themselves who are also transplants like me and might have, you know, found their own ways of exploring beyond where we live. And not to sound like too much of a stereotypical millennial, but I would say social media is really helpful, too. There have been a few times where I've seen something on, you know, Instagram or on Facebook, and it's really caught my interest and taken me to somewhere I might not have sought out otherwise.
Yeah, I've been showing off the state a lot this summer, mm-hmm. you know, to people who mm-hmm. aren't from here, and I find myself exploring things in a much different way. Mm-hmm. So some of these are places, you know, take a cruise on the Mount Washington, go to the Weir's Drive-In Theater. Anything that was a total surprise to you that you or someone else came up with?
One of the things that I was not previously aware of is New Hampshire being home to a record-holding gallery of arcade games in Laconia at Fun Spot. Apparently, there's a ton of kind of indoor pinball games, arcade games of all sorts. I am not personally a big gamer, but it was just kind of neat to know that that was something that was like tucked away in the center of the state that I had no idea existed before this.
That goes on my who knew list as well. So are there yet unexplored parts of New Hampshire that are on your bucket list?
Yeah, so one of my favorite bad jokes is telling people I meet in New Hampshire that I am from the Pittsburgh with an H, as in from Pennsylvania, but I've not yet made it up to the Pittsburgh with a G. So I would like to do that at some point soon.
That is far up mm-hmm. north.
I think what's surprising to me is how vast it is for such a small state geographically. I spent next to no time in New Hampshire before moving here, and it's been really eye-opening to me that it's kind of like a microcosm of all of the different types of regions that you find throughout the country, just in this like tiny corner of it. You have your lakes, your mountains, a little bit of beach, your suburbs, your small cities. So it's kind of like the best of everything in some ways.
Have you ever discovered a spot that turned out to be favorite by mistake or by accident?
When I'm a reporter, sometimes I'll be driving through just kind of a random small town on the way to a destination to interview someone. And there are a few places that have really kind of like taken my breath away, even just like, you know, at the top of a hill heading into like Pittsfield, or I was driving on the way to an interview in Unity earlier this year, and I had never driven that passage between Concord and the western part of the state before on that particular route. And I was just really taken aback at these like beautiful rolling green hills at the height of spring. And I was like, wow, this is, you know, more incentive to kind of get out there and explore a little bit more.
Do you have advice for someone who may be new to New Hampshire on exploring?
So this is not always feasible if you, you know, are working on deadline or on a schedule. But if you have time to spare, don't be afraid to take the long way home. That can be, like I said, where you can find some of the most kind of interesting and off the beaten path spots hidden away. One piece of advice that I would say, though, is if you are going to do that, make sure that you have maybe written down some backup instructions before you set out on your journey, because I've gotten myself into a few situations where my GPS or cell signal has cut out and then I have to just resort to driving and hoping that I find it again.
Casey McDermott, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
We do have a link to the full list of 100 things to do in New Hampshire. It's from boston.com. Casey was one of the co-authors. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Clearly, we all could do some more exploring, but before we hit the road, I think we need to clear up just one last head-scratcher about New Hampshire's highways. Hannah McCarthy is here. Hannah, you ready for this?
Definitely.
Okay, so our listener, Sammer, wrote asking about some missing highway signage. He wanted to know why there is no exit 21 on 93 North in New Hampshire. Did you find out why?
I did, and it was while I was over at the Department of Transportation for the roundabout story, I decided to just ask the powers that be why the numbers jump from 20 to 22. And it turns out that in the 60s, there was a plan to connect Franklin, New Hampshire, to I-93. And that would have happened at exit 21, but the bypass was just never built.
So why skip the number altogether?
Well, they basically had a hold on the exit number while they held hearings about it and they kept the other construction going. So they built exit 22 with the assumption that there would be an exit 21.
So it sounds like the whole system is a little knocked off?
The Federal Highway Administration probably agrees with you. They're asking states to convert from consecutive markers to mileage-based exit signs. And New Hampshire is one of the few states left that hasn't done it yet.
So mileage does make sense. I mean, you would never run into a missing exit issue, but I would think that it would be a pretty massive project.
I think that's actually what's getting in the way. It'd be expensive and a kind of confusing transition, too.
And locals would have to relearn their exit numbers.
And the DOT would have to label new exits as, like, the exit formerly known as 13.
Well, it worked for Prince.
That's fair.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for solving the mystery of Exit 21.
That's what I'm here for.
You're going to be on the ghost beat now. Ghost towns,
wow.
Ghost exits.
I'm into it. I'm ready. Yeah.
And with that, we have run out of road for today. Stick around for Outside In's exploration of that lonesome patch of wildness in the center of a roundabout. That's coming up in just a minute. But first, we want to let you know that this is Word of Mouth's last Sunday episode. Starting next week, we're going to be taking up residence on Saturday mornings at 11 o'clock. That's right after Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And that's not the only change going on. Maybe you've noticed the show's shift of focus lately from ideas and curiosities the world over to answering your questions and exploring your state. With that in mind, we're launching at our new time next Saturday with a look at the Old Man of the Mountain, the beloved historic icon that continues to adorn New Hampshire license plates, state highway signs, and tchotchkes. Still, 14 years after the old stone face crumbled to the ground. So, is it time to move on?
It has no practical purpose anymore, but we're kind of like, hey, this is our history, you know? It's like the Confederate flag without the racism.
We'd like to hear from you. Should New Hampshire change its official state emblem or stick with a bit of fallen history? And for how long? Will it mean anything in the future to those who never saw it?
It's like our family before us. You don't throw away all the pictures after they die, or mementos you got from them, you don't throw them away. You keep them in your heart.
You can weigh in. There's a poll posted on Twitter at Word of Mouth and on the Word of Mouth Facebook page. And tune in next Saturday, September 2nd at 11 to hear the results. Today's show was produced by Hannah McCarthy with Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, and Jimmy Gutierrez. Maureen McMurray is director of Afternoon Walks to Rite Aid. Music in this episode from Broke for Free, Blue Dot Sessions, and Poddington Bear. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stick around. Outside In and Civics 101 are still to come right after the break. A while back, we made a series called 10 by 10 for our Outside In podcast. We wanted to play you an episode from this series about the extraordinary signs of life discovered at the center of the average roundabout. Only problem is we called it a traffic circle. Now we know better. It is not the same thing. Take it away, Sam Evans Brown.
Imagine for a moment that you're standing in anywhere USA, at the edge of a wide circle, a traffic circle. Two busy lanes of traffic curve around the circle in front of you, and highways stretch out in four different directions. A McDonald's squats squarely to your right.
Yeah, can I get an order of hash browns?
There's a Wendy's on your left. And in the middle, what appears to be the world's least interesting island. A boring patch of weedy grass surrounded by oceans of pavement. But let's grab a botanist.
It's really interesting.
It's really interesting.
Dash across the road.
There's no crosswalk.
I got it.
I think right now.
Yeah.
And take a closer look.
You know, it has the structure of a short grass prairie. It looks like something you'd see on the high plains of Montana or eastern Colorado. There's at least 20 different higher plant species out there. At least 20.
I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. Today, another edition of 10 by 10, where we take you on a journey to a 10 by 10 plot and uncover the secrets in spaces you'd never think to look. This time, we look for signs of extraordinary life at the center of an ordinary traffic circle. So honestly, if I were driving past a flat, treeless traffic circle and I said, hey, what's that stuff growing there? You'd say something like,
it's called grass, Sam.
Big whoop. But I'm here to blow your mind with some grass facts. Now, the human branch of the tree of life, the hominids, has 7 species. But grasses have 12,000 species. There are pretty grasses, gross grasses, tall grasses, golfy grasses, sea grasses. Grass, it's not just for lawns. And so while you might just see grass, our botanist, Tom Lee, sees multitudes. First and foremost, the weeds.
Mainly crabgrass. There's some quackgrass, another weed. The common ragweed over there, which causes...
Crabgrass, quackgrass, and that old standby.
Oh, look, dandelion. This is not on my list. I didn't see this yesterday, but this is...
Then there's the pretty stuff. The stuff you'd probably call wildflowers, but can be more accurately described as broadleaf herbs.
Brown-eyed Susans, and there's some kind of a coreopsis right here, and there's...
What's a coreopsis?
Wow, I missed this too. This is butter and eggs, Linaria vulgaris.
There are even a few plants that you might find at your farmer's market.
This is a species called wintergreen, also known as yellow rock. It's not native, but it has these rather fleshy, succulent leaves, which I believe you can put in a salad. I wouldn't put these in a salad, but
maybe after a lot of washing.
After a lot of washing, yeah.
And there is plenty of grass, like grass.
Well, I didn't see this yesterday. This is a little blue stem. In fact, this is the grass that does grow on the high plains. This is a native North American grass that would be a dominant species in the midgrass prairie of Nebraska and Kansas and on up into the Dakotas. And I'm surprised to see that here, but there it is.
So how did a little piece of Nebraska, miles and miles of earth and blue sky, little bees buzzing around, the proverbial home on the range, the actual place where the buffalo roam, how did a miniature version of this bucolic habitat find its way here? Lee estimates that of the 20 to 25 species that he could see on that traffic circle, only about 6 or 7 of them were intentionally planted. The rest somehow crossed this concrete moat on their own.
Isn't that kind of remarkable?
It is. It is remarkable. Some of them blew in on the wind. The fleabanes and the dandelion have those little parachutes that carry them on a breeze. But then there are seeds like those of the evening primrose, which are just small little barrel-shaped things that really aren't dispersed by wind at all, but my guess is they're carried on the bodies of vehicles on a rainy day with some mud splattered up on the side, driving through here, hitting a puddle. The seeds are washed off and sent flying into the center of the circle, and they germinate and grow.
So far, if we're looking for plant life in unexpected places, we're doing pretty well. But what about animals? As far as I could see, there were no cute little rabbits munching on the grass, no coyotes munching on the rabbits, pretty much just plants growing peacefully, quietly. Well, think again, because I've got one little word for you. Nematodes.
If nematodes, if we're talking about them in people, parasites of people, heartworm in dogs, those are nematodes. People don't like to talk about them, you know. But if you look at them in soil, they're pretty cool.
That's Diana Wall, a nematode expert and biology professor at Colorado University. And she's here to introduce us to the secret world of soil microbiology.
I got into it because I think it's one of the most fascinating areas of unknown on the planet.
Nematodes, by the way, are little roundworms, many of them smaller than an eyelash. And soils are teeming with them. Soils, in fact, are teeming with all sorts of crazy stuff.
We know now that almost every phylum, every major group of life above ground, is much reduced below ground. It still may be represented in the soil, but it's going to be at a much smaller size.
Remember the food web you used to study in grade school? The owl eats the shrew, that eats the grasshopper, that eats the leaf. You remember. Most food webs go no further than plants, but there's a whole nother food web, complete with tiny equivalents of herbivores and predators happening right beneath your feet.
Yeah, it's a jungle. It's just a jungle. Or you could just figure out it's a factory and say we're all trying to turn out every car that's ever been made in under one city block. I mean, they're bumping parts and they're moving around and they're passing things off.
Okay, so maybe you've been thinking, weeds, microorganisms, boring. But let's picture this soil food web on a human scale. Imagine for a second that you're down in the soil of the traffic circle. Here, imagine the smallest single-celled organism is about the size of a basketball. If that's how big a bacteria is, now let's think of the biggest organism in the soil food web, an earthworm. They're kind of like the whales of the soil. Now picture those tiny nematodes, the Latronema. Normally, you can just barely see it. It's about 1,000 microns long, which is like 5 or 6 times the width of a human hair. If the earthworm is the length of a college campus, the Latronema is now the size of a school bus. And at the head of this nematode, you'll see something out of a horror movie, a giant mouth with a circular row of gnashing teeth. But that's not all. There are parasitic nematodes that have what look like hypodermic needles sticking out of their mouths. They use it to puncture plant roots like some kind of vegetarian vampire worm.
Well, I'll name another one, a Laphanema, that looks like it's got little elephant ears. It's a nematode that's got a round worm with little elephant ears is what it looks like to me. And then you start looking at others and they look like they have crowns. The very differences in morphology of what things look like. Yeah, this is deep sea. This is outer space. This is science fiction.
This world may be small, but it's crowded, like really crowded.
Normally, in a garden variety soil, in a handful, you would have on the order of 200 billion or so organisms in the soil.
With a B.
200 billion with a B in a handful of soil.
The next time you're digging in the garden, think about that. There are around 28 times the number of organisms in every handful of soil than there are humans living on planet Earth.
And maybe of those 100 billion, you know, several thousand, tens of thousands of different species.
That, by the way, is our third and final scientist for today, UNH soil microbiologist Sarita Frey.
who's here to tell us whether our dry, isolated little traffic circle is just as populated with life as a handful of garden soil. To find out, we'll need to take a few samples.
Soils are very heterogeneous, very highly variable from one place to another.
Highly variable even from here to 20 feet away.
From here to there.
Like 2 feet away.
Or even 2 centimeters away.
All right.
She rips out a handful of grass to expose the dirt and then takes a tulip bulb planter and grinds it down into the soil.
Already I can tell it's pretty sandy.
It's just dust under there.
Yeah.
So, it's really disheartening.
The next thing that I'll
if our aim here is to amaze you with just how much life there is in a traffic circle, this is not a good sign. A lot of soil organisms are technically aquatic animals. They want to live where it's nice and wet. And right now, this region is going through a pretty bad drought. But just as lots of woodland critters hibernate through the winter, many microorganisms have adapted to live under even the harshest environments. Here's Diana Wall.
You can put them under liquid nitrogen. You can put them in a freezer. You could keep them on your shelf for, I don't know, 60 years. I think they've kept some nematodes and just dried in a sack of on a shelf in a lab. And then you bring them back into the lab and say, hey, here's some water. And you can watch them come back to life.
After we get our samples, we run back across the road and head over to Frey's lab. She pops them into mason jars, adds a little water to bring the little buggers back to life, and then leaves it in the awesomely named environmental chamber.
Like a fridge, but whatever you want.
Which is basically a big, sterile, walk-in cooler that's not actually cold.
For this soil, I'm thinking we'll leave it in for a couple of days, and then we'll come back and measure the amount of carbon dioxide that has accumulated.
Just like us, microorganisms breathe in oxygen and exhale CO2. So we estimate how many critters there are just by analyzing the air in the jar.
I don't know if you want to do this or you want me to do it and talk you through it.
Can I do it?
Sure.
Okay, well, okay, all right.
For comparison, we put another sample in the chamber, one that Sarita took from her husband's backyard garden.
That's pretty easy. I feel like I could do this at home, except for the environmental chamber part.
You could.
3 days later, we brought both samples into the lab, extracted some of the air, and tested it for CO2 using an infrared gas analyzer. And lo and behold...
It's like the lead traffic circle might have more.
I think you're right.
Our sandy traffic circle samples showed more microbial activity than the fresh garden soil.
So it's more than twice as much at the lead traffic circle. Wait, was that what you were expecting?
Or were you expecting your husband's?
No, I was not expecting that.
Good job, lead traffic circle.
Just to be clear, we're probably reading too much into these results.
So normally we would have multiple replicates, so we would have, you know... ideally 5 or 6 jars.
But still, in your face, garden soil. Come on. It's hard to not root for the underdog, right?
Soil is considered one of the most diverse habitats on the planet, even, you know, potentially more diverse than a rainforest in terms of the organisms that live there and the complexity of these relationships that you're talking about. And we just know so little about them.
Here's the thing. Even our rainforests have countless species that we have yet to discover, and those are big enough that we can walk around inside of them and look at the species in jars. So just imagine that under your feet, it's like there's a vast and endless rainforest that's too small to see.
Tens of thousands of species in a handful of soil, potentially, and less than 1 to 10% of those are known to science.
Less than 1 to 10% are known to science. And the crazy thing about this is all of those different species that we know nothing about, they're everywhere. Here in New Hampshire, in a traffic circle, we've got our own crazy world. Down in the Amazonian rainforest, they've got theirs. Diana Wall has even found soil microbes under the ice of Antarctica. So remember, next time you're driving on a boring stretch of highway, and you round a dusty patch of overgrown grass, remember that the grass growing there may have hitchhiked for miles on the mud flaps of tractor trailers. Remember that there in the dirt, there are microscopic predators with no names, hunting for a prey that no human has ever seen. Outside In was produced this week by Taylor Quimby and me, Sam Evans-Brown, with help from Maureen McMurray, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, and Jimmy Gutierrez. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Additional music this episode came from Poddington Bear and Ikimashu Aoi. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Is the current Speaker of the House?
Don't even know.
Will they rule in the president's favor or will they send it to the Supreme Court?
You can't refer to a senator directly by their name.
Congressional redistricting.
Separation of power.
Executive orders.
The National Security Council.
Civics 101.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on some of the basics that you may have forgotten or even slept through in school. In a previous episode, we looked at the differences in the way the states and defense departments respectively operate in advancing American interests abroad. Today, we're drilling down into the State Department approach more deeply to answer this question submitted to us by one of your fellow listeners. What do American diplomats actually do on a day-to-day basis? What does it mean to be a diplomat? Johnny Carson was U.S. ambassador to Uganda, Zimbabwe, and most recently to Kenya. He then went on to serve as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Ambassador Carson, what is the role of an ambassador?
Virginia, a U.S. ambassador abroad is the most senior representative of the United States government in a foreign country. The ambassador typically is in charge of a U.S. Embassy, and that embassy serves as an advocate for all U.S. government interests abroad and in that country. And those relationships will vary from country to country, but in many of them, it involves working on trade and commercial and economic issues. It may involve working on security and military issues, and it can, in some countries, be focused heavily on working with a country to deal with a medical or health pandemic like the Ebola virus that consumed the attention of the U.S. embassies in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea some 2.5 years ago.
So tell me what that means on a day-to-day basis. What is an ambassador doing from day-to-day?
An ambassador on a day-to-day basis is consulting with the country team. He may or she may go into the foreign ministry to talk about a issue related to the UN or some international issue. Gaining that country's support for the U.S. position and learning what that country's position is. It may be meeting with local businessmen and bankers and financiers to get a better understanding of the economic concerns of the country.
So a lot of meetings, a lot of FaceTime, it sounds like.
A lot of FaceTime. I would describe a U.S. Ambassador abroad in a medium and large size post as being equivalent to a mayor in a very dynamic and engaged city across the United States. One is doing substantive work, one is doing representational work, and one is doing ceremonial work. The substance may involve a political, economic, or security problem. The representational work may, in fact, be attending a government event that requires the presence of a high-level U.S. Official. A ceremonial event may, in fact, be hosting the July 4th picnic and celebration abroad.
So you did that in Africa? You were hosting July 4th parties when you were in Uganda, Kenya?
Absolutely. Not only for the embassy staff, but for Americans who may be there. In the case of Kenya, there is a large American business community. There is a large missionary community that attends. All of these individuals, as well as senior officials from the government, all of these individuals would be invited to a July 4th celebration.
Does every country have an ambassador?
All countries with which we have diplomatic relations generally have an ambassador. But in places like Iran and North Korea, no. But there are places in the world where we have diplomatic relations but have not elevated the relationship to the point where we have a sitting ambassador. Sudan, for example, Khartoum, where we have an embassy, where we have a chargé d'affaires who is a senior officer, but we do not have a Senate-confirmed ambassador and have not had one there since 1998.
You mentioned the Senate confirmation. Ambassadors are nominated by the president. Then they need to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. But tell us, there are a couple of different kinds of appointments here. There are sort of political appointments, and then there are people who are career foreign service officers who make their way up through the Department of State. You are the latter.
Correct.
What is the difference in those kind of appointments?
The difference is one of professional career. The other is the result of political appointment and political favoritism, which is certainly permissible and acceptable under the U.S. Constitution. Career diplomats generally enter the Foreign Service through a written and oral examination process. They will serve typically 15 to 20 years before they receive their first ambassadorial appointment. That appointment is made on the basis of merit, accomplishment, experience. A non-career ambassador, a political appointee, is generally someone who is favorably known to the president. They are people who have generally donated large amounts of money and or time or prestige to a president's or a party's political success. Those are seen to be political rewards, not professional rewards.
And we've seen more of these in recent years, the rise of political appointments to ambassadorships over career foreign service officers. What does that mean in terms of how you're serving a country?
I think a professional officer brings a great deal more international experience, understanding, and knowledge to the job. They are people who are fully aware of the operations of the State Department, or conversant with the policies in the country where they're serving, the region where they're serving. They not only, in large measure, have regional expertise, they have linguistic expertise, they have cultural awareness. Political appointees, and we have had some outstanding political ambassadors, but we also have had political appointees, sadly, who have not met any of the basic criteria of knowing the country, the history, the policies of the United States. And those individuals tend to diminish the record of outstanding political appointees by the lack of understanding and knowledge that they bring to the table. In both Republican and Democratic administrations, there have been some political failures, political ringers.
Is there a moment, Ambassador Carson, in your Foreign Service career where you saw very clearly that diplomacy was working, you know, soft power was paying off as compared to military power, hard power, threats even?
In Malawi in 2012, the State Department our ambassador on the ground, and our officials in Washington, including then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, convinced military leaders and opposition politicians not to intervene to prevent a sitting vice president from assuming the presidency after the president had died of a stroke. There were individuals in government who did not want the vice president, who happened to be a woman, to succeed to the presidency. But it was through a great deal of discussion that they and we prevailed to ensure that there would be a peaceful transition of power. So there are many instances out there where quiet diplomacy, negotiation, and engagement do in fact help to stop what could turn out to be violence and ongoing conflict.
Who do ambassadors report to?
Generally, because there are a large number, they generally are reporting back to regional assistant secretaries and on to the Secretary of State. As you can imagine, with issues related to Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, North Korea, the senior officials overseas generally have a direct or near direct line to the Secretary of State and to the White House, given the centrality and importance of those issues.
After the impact of major international events like 9/11 and Benghazi, for example, how have you seen diplomacy change over the years in your career alone?
I think the two or three most startling changes have to do with the introduction of the internet, telephone conferencing, both unclassified and secure, have speeded up the level of communication and have speeded up the decision-making process. Secondly, security. We live in a much more insecure world, and so security has been substantially increased. We have lots of high walls. We have lots of security personnel. We have Marine security guards at virtually all of our facilities abroad. We have fewer and fewer United States information libraries that were the mainstay of the U.S. face in many countries and many capitals. And we've seen, thirdly, an expansion of U.S. government personnel outside of the State Department in larger embassies, whether it be the Department of Defense with its defense attachés, whether it be the Department of Agriculture with its agricultural attachés. All of these organizations are now looking to have their representatives in major embassies. I might also add that the Department of State does an enormous service for the American people in representing and advocating for America. But it is still one of the smallest cabinet departments, and it still remains significantly under-resourced for the kind of serious and hard work that it does in some 170 plus nations.
So with possible cuts to the Foreign Service budget announced by this administration, what would be lost?
Our leadership ability, our ability to project programs that support our policies and our principles.
Ambassador Johnny Carson, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
Johnny Carson, he was U.S. ambassador to Uganda, Zimbabwe, and most recently to Kenya. He's now senior advisor at the U.S. Institute of Peace. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Jimmy Gutierrez with help from Taylor Quimby. Music in this episode from Broke for Free. If you're looking to expand your understanding of civics, sign up for our weekly extra credit newsletter. It's a fast track to becoming a teacher's pet. You'll get supplemental reading lists for the topics that we cover, some pop quizzes to see how much you've retained, and tips on how to remain an engaged citizen, all delivered to your email box. There's a link to sign up at civics101podcast.org, and that's where you can send us your questions about the fundamentals of democracy by email or text or voice memo. Chances are pretty good. We'll use it for a future episode. I'm Virginia Prescott, and Civics 101 is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.